What's up, y'all, and welcome back to Candidly Speaking. My name is Carrie Lippert-Gillespie, and I am your hostess with the mostest. I'm so glad y'all are here today, and I hope you're ready for another amazing interview episode. This one is going to be something a little different than what I've done before, and I'm going to tell you a little bit more about it. But before we get into it, I have to tell you that I spent the last, 10 days on a little vacay, kind of, back home in Wisconsin. And it was really great. You know, it was a vacation, but I was busy pretty much the entire time. I had a couple of days where I had some downtime. And, you know, as much as I would love to take a vacation on a sunny beach, it's not in the cards right now. So, alas, I went home and I put together and hosted my first spay and neuter clinic for outdoor cats for 2021. This is my fifth total clinic that I've done, which is amazing and so rewarding. And you guys know I'm really passionate about animal welfare and adopt, don't shop, and spay and neuter. So it was a grand old time and a huge success. And we were able to sterilize and vaccinate 82 outdoor cats in just 2 days, which is pretty incredible, if I do say so myself. So that was the big reason why I went home, but I also spent some time just relaxing. It was kind of rainy and dreary some of the time, so there was definitely a day where I was a literal bum and did not move from bed, and oh my gosh, it was heavenly. Then there was a day where I went and did some stuff outside. My family owns a lot of land out there, so there's always, stuff to pick up. We have a lot of woods, and there's always woods cleanup, you know, type of stuff, especially after the spring. So went out and helped my brother, who was also in town with his wonderful fiance, spent some time with them. Got to see a bunch of my favorite people that I always try and make it a point to go see when I'm back in town. So it was a good time had by all. And then I made the 8-hour trip back to Kansas City yesterday, which, was not horrible. I just put on some podcasts and just grind on through the drive. It's not the best, but it's also not the worst. Now, after I record this intro, I am going to my first exercise class in about 10 days. So pray for me because it probably ain't going to be pretty. You know, I usually work out 4 to 5 days a week, which is great. Keeps me sane, keeps me, fit and, you know, just feeling good. And, you know, where my family lives, there's not a lot of exercising options. Sometimes I'll run outside, but, you know, it's just not running outside type of weather in Wisconsin yet. So I did about no exercise while I was up there, and I am prepared to really be in some pain after this class, but I'm just gonna suck it up. I'm not looking forward to it, so just pray for me. All the personal updates out of the way, let's get into today's episode, and let me tell you about this guest and about this story that she's going to share with us today, because today's episode is a little bit different than normal. Normally, I have on people and they tell me kind of their origin story and, you know, how they got to be where they are and whatnot, but this episode was specifically me wanting to have a conversation with someone who was on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, depending on where you are probably right around a year out of lockdown. I know lockdowns vary from, you know, wherever you were. If you were in a big city, New York, or if you were in a more rural area like I was, your lockdown date can vary from, you know, a week or two or something like that. But most of us have gotten to the point where it's been a full year since the first COVID lockdown. And, you know, I don't work in the medical field, obviously. Thank God. That would be a catastrophe if I'd ever seen one. And I don't have a lot of people really close to me who are in the medical field. So for me, it was very abstract what was going on. I would hear stories, but they, you know, how things all are, it gets lost and everything becomes folklore and stories get exaggerated or changed. And then I would turn on the news and that was just god awful. I mean, when is the news not god awful, to be quite honest? So a lot of it I felt really removed from in terms of what was going on. And so I really just wanted to get an honest story or honest perspective from someone who experienced it on the front lines and could give me the truth, the good, the bad, the ugly. And my guest today, Brittany Sheffert, who is a registered nurse at a hospital in Lincoln, Nebraska, she gave me just that. She was very transparent and very just forthcoming about every aspect of it, which I really appreciated. She did such a good job articulating the ins and outs of it and how it was for her, you know, professionally, but then we also talked about how it affected her personally because she was a young mother. They have a young child, her and her husband have a young child. So how it kind of affected her as a mom, and her husband is a teacher. And so that's another aspect of, you know, that has really another profession that's really been affected by this. So she did such a good job articulating and really bringing to light and just explaining and giving the perspective from what was going on kind of from the inside. And I appreciated it so much. And I know you guys are really going to enjoy this. And I just think that this was a story that I wanted to be able to share. Maybe you have, you know, relatives or loved ones or a spouse that works in the medical field and you didn't feel as, you know, removed from it. But I felt so removed. And a big part of me was like, I just want to know from someone who's seen this day in and day out what it's like. And that's when I put out a call on Instagram and Brittany responded. I'm so glad she did. Again, she did an amazing job. And I think you guys are really going to enjoy this episode and really enjoy just, you know, hearing her perspective. Even though the topic is heavy, you can enjoy hearing about a sad, you know, topic. Just enjoy hearing the perspective. You know, this past weekend, I watched, when I was being a veg, one of those days on my vacation, I watched a documentary called Seaspiracy. And it was a really hard documentary to watch. It was kind of a somber topic, talking about how we are ruining the ocean and thus kind of ruining the world slowly but surely. And it was a hard topic to watch, but nevertheless, I enjoyed watching it because it was so informative and it really just shifted my perspective. And so, yeah, I think that this will be something similar where the topic is going to be heavy, but I hope you enjoy listening to her perspective and getting a glimpse into what it was like for her as an RN during this time and over the past year. So I'm going to leave it at that and I'm going to let you guys do the listening and just hear for yourselves because I think you're going to love it. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Brittany Sheffert. Brittany, thanks so much for being here. Welcome to the show. How's it going?
Thank you. Good. Just, you know, enjoying this nice like 60 degree weather day, finally getting a little bit of heat here. So
yeah,
can't be concerned about that much.
Yeah, it was 75 yesterday in Kansas City. We went to like and drank a beer outside because we're like, we need some sun. Let's go.
Literally, right? Get some vitamin D going for once, for gosh sakes.
Yeah. Tell everyone where you're coming to us from so they have some geographical placement here.
Sure. Yep. Lincoln, Nebraska. So I've been living here for about 7 years and working at the hospital that I currently work at for about 3. So good old Lincoln, right in the Midwest.
Yeah, right in the Midwest. Now, I'm glad you mentioned the hospital that you work at. Let's talk more about that. Tell us, you know, what your title is and where you work at in the hospital.
Yeah, so I'm a registered nurse. I work at Bryan West Hospital. There's two campuses here in Lincoln. I work at the Trauma Center campus. And I work on a med-surg oncology floor is what kind of our specialize is. So a lot of bariatric surgeries, kind of abdominal surgeries. We kind of a catch-all floor, I call us, just because we get a little bit of everything. And then as well as like the chemo and radiation patients as well. So we get a lot of variation as far as patients go.
Yeah. Let's go back to March of 2020, which has been almost a year. Like, I mean, I remember starting to hear rumblings about COVID and the coronavirus back in like January of 2020, but it seemed kind of so far away and we seemed so removed from it because it was still kind of half a world away. So as it was building up to it, what was like the word going around, you know, in your hospital from the doctors you worked with? What was like the word going around initially?
So, you know, right off the bat, our infectious disease doctors it was kind of like a mixed review, if you will, about what was going to happen with the virus. Right away, all of us nurses were like, it's like the flu, you know, it's no big deal. We get the flu every year. People go through it. You get it, you know, there's so many different strains, then it's done. We were already going in, you know, coming out of flu season last year. So we'd already been like, no big deal. Here we go. Just add on something else, you know, that we're going to be seeing. So, but the biggest first thing that they did was they required masks right off the bat. I do remember at our hospital that we usually don't ever use masks unless it's for a flu patient, things like that. That was the first thing that was like, holy cow. They, you know, as when March hit, masks started. And I think that was kind of like a point where we all were like, this is so annoying. Why are we doing this? They started in all these different things where like, you know, prior to COVID, anytime we came in and left a room, if it were a flu patient, mask was off and you threw it away, got a new mask on. Now the mask stayed on all the time. Mask never was changed and mask just stayed on at all times. So that was something that was a little bit different. Just kind of right off the bat, the mixed reviews, what was this going to be with this? Is it going to be more serious than what we thought? Was this going to be just a low key, like the flu, no big deal? So that's kind of how it started out last year, you know, initially.
Yeah. It was just kind of one of those things where like, it's coming. And I remember feeling that too. It's like, it's coming. It can't be that bad. And you know, part of the reason why I felt like it can't be that bad is because like, I'm a millennial. I'm about to turn 30 in like 6 months or so. I've never seen nothing like this has ever, you know? So in my mind, I couldn't conceptualize something that shut the world down. You know, our parents' generation or, you know, way before grandparents, they had polio and they had these other things. where they could conceptualize, you know, mm-hmm. a disease that kind of took over. But in my head, I was like, this isn't going to happen.
Right. You hear that word pandemic and you're like, yeah, you hear about, yeah. You think about like the past, you're like, okay, you know, like we've got vaccines now, everything's going to be good. We're not going to see anything like that in our lifetime. So I think that was kind of like an initial, like, I never thought my first, you know, 5 to 10 years of nursing, I would ever see anything like this, just because it was such a challenging aspect to it. So yeah, I think that was kind of a little bit of a shock when you hear that word and you're like, oh, you know, you don't know how to act because we don't know. We just don't, we can't. We've never encountered something like this. So I think that's why it's such a big deal.
Yeah. 1000%. Now, I don't know about you, but at the time we were in like rural central Wisconsin. And when things got really bad, like let's say in New York is where it really broke out, it really still wasn't bad for us in rural Wisconsin. Like we would get a case here and there, but like when it was really busting out in New York, we were all just pretty much chilling. And so part of us was like, this isn't as big of a deal or it's not going to affect us. Our breakout, like in the rural areas, happened much later, like this past fall. What would you say? Right. How did it go for you guys?
Very similar. You know, I think for the most part, that was the reasons why we were kind of questioning it. Like, we haven't seen anything here. There's been like one case here, there, pop up, no big deal. I think a little bit of a turning point was for me, I think it was probably right after the midst of, you know, the pandemic kind of hitting its worst in New York, there was a nurse from here locally that we had known that was a traveler that chose to go out to New York. And his review of what was going on would give you goosebumps. And I think that was my point where I was like, holy cow, this is a little bit worse than what I think any of us truly know. You know, we hear of how sick people are getting and how quickly people are dying and that kind of thing. But from a worker's perspective of where they could freely talk about it kind of was scary. I mean, it was scary as a nurse. It was scary for the patients. It was scary for all workers involved. Things definitely weren't safe, but they didn't have the workload to be able to make it as safe as what they wish they could. So I think that was a little bit taking aback, you know, as far as like being here and being like, okay, everything's so chill. It was kind of the calm before the storm. You're waiting for that storm to happen. So that was kind of a little freaky feeling kind of in the back of your head sitting there being like, when is it our turn? You know?
Yeah, exactly. And when it finally did hit, what was it like overnight or did they just kind of creep in?
Seriously, overnight. It went from like my unit converted. So there was three units on our hospital, my campus. First one was the ICU ICU converted half of their ICU. So we're 24 beds on each kind of side of our hospital. So the ICU converted, I think it was like 10 or 12 beds on their floor. The floor above us is a progressive floor. So kind of a step down from an ICU. They can do everything until you're ventilated. They have 24 beds. They were completely full. They went to us next. We're a general care floor. We actually just converted to PCU as well. So I'm going through a bunch of training for that. They converted us right around Halloween time. It was like in the beginning of October. It went from like all of a sudden, you know, I worked the day we converted. Our manager came out and said, hey guys, we got people sitting in the ED that are COVID positive and we have no place for them to go. We're converting today. So we literally had, you know, our half was essentially, I think they started out with just 10 beds on our floor. So they did half and half. They can make the different floors airborne kind of rooms without making the whole floor airborne. They change off the ventilation systems in each individual room. So we got all 10 patients off of that half of our side, transferred them onto other floors, gave report, and we got 10 straight back in. I mean, it literally was just like a flood right back in. So that was super overwhelming the first day. I think just because I've been PAPR trained clear back when I first became a nurse. And anytime we have a tuberculosis patient, then I would have to put a PAPR on. Reeducated myself every single time something like that came on because you don't use them as often, you know. So we were given the COVID patients, had no idea as far as protocols, had no idea how to operate these PAPRs, what we were supposed to do with our gowns and our gloves and our masks. We had no idea. We were literally thrown into it. And it's our job to take care of these patients. So I think that's another aspect too, is a lot of these nurses may not be specialized, you know, per se. I kind of do a variety of different patients, but this was a different patient population than what your typical patient population coming in is. The reason being, you know, you have a patient that comes in is sick and they've got something going on with their heart and they have, you know, a small bowel obstruction and they have these different things that you're like, okay, I know what I'm doing and I know how to address this. And I know that I've got people on my team and my doctors that know how to address this. With these COVID patients, we were trialing things to hope to get to things that would work for them. Mm-hmm. I think that was the scariest thing is we truly did not know what was going to work or how to completely heal these patients. It was more, let's hope to God we can treat the symptoms and at least maintain the symptoms to the point where they don't get worse.
Yeah.
So I think that aspect was kind of scary on the first time that it like was just like a flood.
Yeah.
And then ever since October, it held steady to the point where we had so many people waiting and, you know, we had patients that were declining super quick on our floor that we were sending off to other floors in the ICU and getting patients right back up. Our ED downstairs had a whole overflow unit that they converted. Our mental health unit actually concealed the whole floor to get general care patients onto there to open up more space on our hospital for COVID. So it was a lot of transitioning and a lot of unknowns. And every day we heard of new medications that were going to get started. And does this one truly work? And it was like, well, we don't know, but we're going to try it. And so relaying that information to your patients is such a delicate ground, if you will, because we don't know either. You know, we don't know the side effects. We don't know this and that. And for us to be like, look, but it's the only option we have isn't the most convincing thing you've ever said to a patient, you know? So.
Yeah.
That's tough.
And I know, you know, the reason why I'm having you on is because I have like zero medical experience or anything like that. So I love that I can have you on to talk about this. But like, from my point of view, like, I know nothing about the medical field. So like, when I go to a doctor or talk to a nurse, like, I literally need you to explain to me what's going on with me and how we can heal it or what we can do. Because I have no clue. I'm so clueless when it comes to stuff like that. So and I like expect that from you and, you know, to be in one of those positions and you guys have to like rightfully, honestly, just be like, look, this is brand new. Like we're not 100% sure how we can help you right now. And I'm sure for you guys, that's like, it's tough to say, cause you're not used to saying that. Like you said, you have protocols for everything, but there's no protocol for this.
Right. And that's it. They were trying to do it so quickly overnight and develop these protocols. And, you know, there was different machines as far as like your BiPAPs and CPAPs that you hear people are on for this COVID and Airvos, which are like high flow oxygen. We learned overnight what these things were because you on occasion saw things. Your respiratory therapists obviously are there to help. They are so overwhelmed in this situation because they are one of the primary caregivers in this sense, because almost every single person that comes in is on an oxygen need. Mm-hmm. So they're so overwhelmed. They go from having two or three patients they're doing treatments on a floor to the entire floor. So I don't think people recognize that either enough. You know, they always talk about like on this pandemic, like go nurses, go doctors. I would have died without my respiratory therapist.
Yeah.
All day. Anytime that I started panicking about a patient that was declining severely, I would call my RT first, right off the bat. Oxygen needs are going down. I need you up here now. Yeah. And then I would call my doctor, obviously, too. But RT, they don't get enough recognition for the things that they did during the pandemic, just because for them, it was so overwhelming, just as much as it was for us.
Yeah.
I think that's important to point out, especially just because they don't get brought up enough for all the help that they've done. So
yeah. That makes total sense. What was the protective gear that you had to wear? I have a friend from college. She's in like she does something with radiology, I think, or something. Uh-huh. Like that. But she would tell me she had these, and she wasn't even like a nurse or anything, but they had these suits almost that, and she had to, when she got home, take her clothes off in the garage. Like she didn't bring them in the house. And so what was just your protective layer like to protect you?
Yeah. So I would wear like gym clothes to work, change into Brian's scrubs, the hospital scrubs that would be available right away for us when we got there. go in, hairnet on, and I would put usually another cap on because sometimes with the PAPRs, I started getting sores on my ears from it rubbing so much. And they just give you throbbing headaches when they press against you kind of throughout too. So then you go in anytime. So we pretty much had all the doors shut, which creates that kind of negative airflow to not allow for the air essentially to go in and out of the rooms. So that was a challenge as far as a lot of our population were older patients. A lot of them were fall risks, what we call them, meaning they have dementia, Alzheimer's, things like that, unsteady on their feet, and they are easy to fall. That was a little scary because our doors were always closed. We had cameras in a lot of the rooms to be able to see kind of what was going on. It's called Occubera. It's a safety measure for a lot of our patients. So anytime you go into a room, gown first, they liked you. At first, we had so many things different changed. One set of gloves, gown, another set of gloves, and then mask, and then papper. So then, and then footies, we had to put over booties, kind of like over our shoes. So you could go, it used to be right off the bat, anytime you left a room, ungown, unglove, everything, strip down, go to your next room, redo it all again. Then they changed the policy and let us do where we could, if it was a positive to a positive COVID room where it wasn't a rule out, you could wear the same gown, same, not have to clean your papper, same booty, same everything like that. Just change your gloves. Then they went and said, we no longer want you to double glove. We want you to single glove. So it was kind of like, as we were evolving through it, because we also had to, you know, we were losing PPE. So we had to make sure that we were conserving as much as we could. The gloves and the gowns were one of those things that we severely started going under on. And they started getting us like reusable gowns. So then it were cotton, kind of cotton gowns. Those we would take off between each room pretty much. Just cause they tied, we sit, put them in a linen bag. They would get washed in a special washing solution. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of starting out, and that kind of carried along with us as far as the gowns, the gloves, mask, booties, hairnet, papper. And the papper is not a full bodysuit. It is just a hood that has a hose behind it that filters the air that's going into you. Okay. So it's clean air essentially that comes into you every time that you walk into a patient room.
Oh my gosh, it's like a hazmat suit, sounds like.
Literally, you look like, I literally would like tell my patients, like, just us alien, like we literally look like astronauts walking in. Back, you know, I worked on Halloween and I was like, look, I like have a Halloween costume. Like, you gotta find some humor in something, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of like in the moment, but I was like, yeah, we literally look like we're wearing costumes all the time, so.
What was it like? You're a mother, you have a young child. What was it like? Did you have to spend time away from your baby, or did you have to just be really careful when it came to coming back to her at the end of the day?
Yeah, so we really debated this at first. You know, I know people that chose to stay in other places, not be around their kids, their husbands. I was not willing to sacrifice that time away from her. So I was extra careful on what I did. I did the same thing. I stripped it out in the garage, threw everything in the laundry. Thankfully, I had it all. My laundry room is right next to my garage. Threw everything in there. Would go straight up or straight upstairs and shower. I would not pass go. I would not touch her. Wouldn't talk to Josh. I would literally just go straight in the shower. So nothing in, even though I didn't even wear the clothes onto the floor, they were just like my gym clothes. I would still wash everything. My shoes stayed outside. I would spray my shoes usually like once a week with some bleach on the bottom of them. And then spray like Lysol over the top of them just to keep things semi feeling like they're clean out there. But I did not want to sacrifice the time spent away from her or him. So I chose to stay home still. And we never had issues with it as far as, you know, anyone getting sick. My husband got COVID from something else, a wedding. So we learned that quickly too, that was not a place to be. But her and I thankfully had remained healthy. So as far as I know, I still have not had COVID. So the measures obviously work that I had taken at the hospital. So.
Yeah, that's incredible. I know that was a tricky thing. I saw that on the news a lot with people who are on the front lines and having to spend time away from their families in some cases. And if they have young, you know, young children, or even, you know, people who had to deliver or go to pregnancy appointments, you know, sans their, you know, significant other. And I just can't imagine what that's like. So I would love to hear from your perspective what it was like to have to treat these patients, and they're really sick and struggling, and you know, the thing that helps is your family and loved ones, and they have to be alone.
Right. You know, I think that is the most heartbreaking portion of it. We no longer were just, you know, there to help with symptom and medical management. We were their person. Throughout the entire stay. You know, the one nice thing is, you know, we usually work 2 to 3 days in a row. And we would get those patients back when we had them. So there was a familiar face. They could at least start to learn about us or who we were a little bit. But it was heartbreaking. There's no other way around it. There'd be patients that would sit there and be like, am I going to die? And I would look at them and say, I don't know, because I didn't. You know, it was a day-to-day thing. One day you would walk in and be like, oh my gosh, this patient's going to go home tomorrow. Oh, sorry. Are you there?
No, you're still here.
Okay, sorry. It like paused on me. My screen went black. one day you walk in, the patient would be like, you're like, oh, they're going to go home. They're looking good. Their oxygen needs are like down to 2 liters, which they would send people home on oxygen all the time, which was great. And then the next minute you would walk in the next day and they would be up on ICU. I mean, it was like that quick. But then you'd also have people on the opposite who would be on BiPAP to the point where we were sending them off our unit to go to ICU as well to talk about ventilation. And you'd walk in the next day and they'd been weaned down to 5 liters. And you're like, what's what, you know what I mean? There was no, I think that was one of the hardest things with these patients is there was no one direct pathway this virus took. Didn't matter if you were old, didn't matter if you were young. There was no one direct pathway. So for me to sit there and be like, yeah, you're going to get better. Like you're down to 2 liters. This is really good. I couldn't give them that false hope.
Yeah.
Some patients, you know, that my general population that I deal with now, it's easy for me to be like, okay, this is generally how things go. People usually day one feel like this, you know what I mean? I can kind of show them the progression with this. I couldn't. And that was really hard. There were a lot of emotional moments that I had with patients that were feeling like they were dying and, or they did die. Mm-hmm. And at first we were not even allowing family at all to come in and say goodbye. Mm-hmm. Thank God as kind of things got worse. And we had a lot more people dying. They did allow for compassionate visits is what they called it. Okay. Where they allowed for 2 family members to come in. They had to be completely done up just like we were. Sign a bunch of essentially releases saying, if you get COVID, it's on you. And they got to spend 30 minutes with that patient before they died. And that was it. Mm-hmm. At the end of that 30 minutes, they were ushered out. And I think that for me was one of the hardest things I've gone through, because you have family that are just reaching for some sort of hope and you're the one outlet that's usually there to give them some sort of like, yeah, here's how the day's, you know, and we just had no hope to give on some of these people. And people who would get transferred from smaller hospitals around Nebraska and they get transferred and they'd be like, oh, you know, they're doing okay. And the next day they'd be in the ICU dying. So, that was hard. That was really, really hard. And I know that was hard and draining on doctors and nurses and RTs. There was no one person that it was tough on, no more than so than the other. I think for nurses, we get the most face-to-face time.
Yeah.
And it's hard because we were responsible for calling all the family members each day. They changed a policy where they wanted us to call family members at least once a day to give them an update on each patient that we had. Doing so, it was never a fun conversation usually. So yeah, I think that was the hardest thing is we were not only just the caregivers, we were their support system. We had to hold their hand while they were feeling like they were going to die. You know, and trying to give them hope in some sense, but also we didn't want to give them a false hope, you know? Yeah. So that was tough.
Yeah. And just to see the anguish and to know that, that's all you want. And even, you know, I think about it, like I think about when my grandma passed away a couple of years ago and we were all, you know, I have a lot of cousins and we were all cuddled in this room. You know, we knew she was passing. She was 90, 95 plus. She lived a great life. We knew she was passing, but we all were huddled around her bed and like holding hands and surrounding her. And like, I just think of like having to pick just 2 of us to do that, you know, would be so tough.
You know, and the other part of that too, is I'm sure, you know, going through that with your grandma, you've seen just how much dignity people hold for the bodies and how much respect that we give to those bodies, especially, you know, in the hospital setting, we do everything, we cleanse the bodies and get everything ready for them to go to a mortuary. It was so disheartening because we did not treat the COVID bodies as they should have, because we had a policy to follow in the event that something would spread post COVID death. And I think that ripped nurses apart more than anything, because that was our job to take care of the patient's bodies. I'll never experience anything like that ever again in my life, I hope.
Yeah.
But that was sickening. There was no other word for it. It was sad. It was sickening. I felt like I was just wrapping up something that didn't matter. And not having, you know, we gave it as much respect as we could, but we had a way that we had to do things. And that was by far, I don't think I'll have anything else in my career that ever hits me that much as that did.
Yeah. Just see, and it's like, you don't want to do this. You don't really have to treat it like this, but it's like, you have to for the safety of yourself and other people. So it's one of those things where it's like, oh, this is killing me to do this, I'm sure. But it's also like, this is what we have to do.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's the thing. It's like, if I could change up the policies that they made us do, I obviously would, but it was what they, not only our hospital was doing, it's what every hospital across the nation was doing, but you know what I mean? As far as when the people had passed. So, yeah, I think that was the most disheartening and, you know, hard thing to go through.
What have things been like now? How long would you say it was kind of balls to the walls? I know here in Kansas City, things have slowed down some and they're actually loosening up some restrictions. We still have to wear masks, but like the restaurants can be open till whatever time they want. And I think they could have more people in capacity. So things have calmed down some, but it's not gone. So what's it been like there?
Yeah. So, you know, the worst of the worst probably hit it like the end of October, beginning of November. And it was all hands on deck. Our whole floor transitioned. Like I said, there were like two or three floors on the East Campus. So a lot of patients that were in for COVID. So we went pretty dang fast all the way through the holidays. I remember we were having to pick up extra shifts because our needs were so high. And our chief nursing officer came on and said, like, I know a lot of you requested days off on the holidays. They may not be granted now because we need help. Yeah. So I think that was kind of that was hard too, because that is our job to be there for those patients and to do those things. For our mental sake, we needed days away from the hospital because it was so depressing being there. You don't have visitors the same way that you normally do. Most times you're in the PAPR for, you know, we had four or five patients at a time. And you want to crank out as much as you can while you're in that PAPR. So you'd be in there for 2 or 3 hours at a time, going from patient room to patient room. Your interaction with the nurses, even that you are on that floor with, were way less than what you initially did. The burnout rate was so high. So I think there was a lot of loneliness in that too, for just being on the floor and working as a nurse. So pretty much probably end of October all the way till about beginning of January, things started to slow down. We started kind of taking back some of our rooms. Surgery started kicking back in. They allowed elective surgeries to come back in, kind of doing just where they just need either one overnight stay or outpatient. And our floor is mainly surgical. So they wanted to keep our floor open just because it was a general care population where we could kind of take a little bit of everything as far as the COVID needs go as well. But we started getting surgicals too. So then having to staff out who does the COVID, who does the surgicals, you know, we had a lot of pregnant women on our floor that could not work during this time. So they were going to other floors helping out. Totally understandable. And so I think, you know, that transition time was weird too, because we were having nurses that wanted to just get done with the COVID and not work it anymore. But we were trying to all take our turns kind of transitioning into that area. So yeah, that was probably beginning of January. And then actually probably about a month ago, beginning of February-ish, we closed our units. That was huge. I remember getting a text being like, our last patient just left and our unit's closed. So that was like a woo, you know, moment. Every floor at our hospital has 3 airborne rooms. So they're just consistently, they're in our middle section. Every floor has them. Those are all full still. So we still have 3, you know, however many times 6. So typically we usually have about, I think, 10 to 12 patients still on our campus. East, I'm not so sure how many they have now. So there's definitely still traces of it. Way different though than what it was before. Yep. You know, some of these people have had COVID for months and months and months, are still testing positive, and they've come in for something else. Hmm. But since they're still testing positive, they'll put them in and do an airborne room. So that's kind of one thing that's unique too with that virus, is how long people are testing positive, even without the symptoms now. So yeah.
You mentioned this earlier before, but from my point of view and from what I've seen from other people, it's one of those things where it's affected so many people in so many different ways. I've heard some friends who are my age who have had it, and they were out for, you know, they're still pretty young, but they're out for 3 weeks and it kind of lingers and whatnot. And then I've heard some people who are even older, in their 50s or 60s, they've had it and they've said it's maybe just like flu-like. And then I've heard all types of, you know, reactments of how it's affected them. So I think, as you said before, it's affected people in so broad of ways.
Yes.
It's so unpredictable.
Yes, it is. And, you know, I always tell people, I still had this like persona in my head, like, okay, this attacks, you know, older people, it's the older generation, it's not that bad. I think until I actually was in it, and realized how bad it was, you know, and then I started seeing younger population too. So I think one of my youngest patients that did not do well was about 34. And it just hit him hard, and it was bad. And he was in the hospital for months and months and months. We had his youngest 24, 25 year olds. Did they also have some comorbidities? Yes, they did. They had, you know, diabetes was a huge thing we saw on our floor associated with the COVID. Obesity was huge. COPD, so anything with their lungs, prior asthma, things like that were huge indicators that their symptoms were usually worse. But then you would also have our patients who were some of our oncology patients who had lung cancer and had half of a lung left on their left side, and they left totally fine. So it was like, that was just so, a person that you would have totally thought would have gotten hit worse by the virus and probably not survived it, left the hospital and was doing totally fine. So it is so, so bizarre how the virus works and how it attacks. And I just had one of my best friends, her uncle just died about 3 weeks ago. He was in his 50s, completely healthy guy, very fit, very, there was nothing else that he had as far as issues go. And it hit him and it took him. It went, I mean, it went from just like, he was really sick and, you know, they transferred him from hospital to hospital, got him to the University of Iowa. And it completely took him over. It started causing disease on his heart, both of his lungs, and it just that quick. So I think that's the biggest thing is, you know, how much variation and how strong of a virus it actually is. I think people can always downplay it, and I have personally done it to myself. I think until I was really in it, and just seeing how serious of a virus and illness it is, you know.
Yeah. How do you feel about things moving forward? You know, I saw President Biden said that there should be enough vaccinations for, I think, everyone. I think he said was what I heard yesterday, by like, I don't know, May or something. I mean,
right.
I don't have the facts. I should have it, but I don't.
No, you're good.
But, no. You know, vaccinations I keep hearing are supposed to be around. How are you feeling about the vaccination and the prospect of having, you know, herd immunity by May?
Right. You know, so our hospital was allowed to get vaccinations probably about a month and a half ago. It was offered to all of us. I would still say probably about 70-30 as far as the nurses that got it and nurses that didn't. For own personal reasons, you know, obviously the hesitation of a lot of women who are in the childbearing years are hesitant about getting it. And I totally understand that. You know, I think the biggest thing is not to judge either way, just to let people kind of make their own decision on this. This is still very new, even though it's been around for a year, this pandemic, it's still scary to people. The unknowns are still scary to people. A brand new vaccine that comes out that we don't have a lot of information on is still scary to people. So I think giving people grace with when the vaccines come out and are able to give to everyone, not everyone's going to want to get it, and that's okay. You know? But I think getting the older general population vaccinated, which majority of people are, is huge. Mm-hmm. That is going to be the biggest, that's the biggest population that's getting sick. So getting as far as herd immunity goes, I think that they're saying if we can get people vaccinated by this summer, to expect herd immunity by the earliest of this fall, which would be huge. It's never going to go away. And we know that. It's like the flu. There's going to be new strains that come about. There's new, you know, things that go on with it that the vaccines are going to have to be manipulated and changed every year. But I've also read studies where they're saying now antibodies are lasting longer than what they predicted they would. That's also huge because they didn't really know that either. You know, a lot of people had talked about when you're getting COVID, it depends on your exposure, how much your antibodies really develop and how strong they are and how long they last, which was also very unique for a virus. Most times when we get viruses, your body builds antibodies, you become immune to it. You are not immune to strains, but you're immune to the strains that you've been encountered with. That was what was kind of unique and different about COVID was they didn't know. And they didn't know, they were seeing that people who were 3-4 months out from getting it the first time were actually getting it again, which is super bizarre for a virus. That's not typical. That's not what we learned in medical books. That's not what doctors learned in medical books. And it wasn't a different strain. It was the same strain. So I think that was something that was different with COVID too. But I'm hoping that it gives people a little bit more encouragement to get back to a sense of normalcy, to start living their lives how we did before. I don't think things will ever 100% be the same again, just because, for example, us at the hospital, I think we will forever wear masks. I don't think we'll ever get away from the masks. And that's okay. You know, it's whatever gives people a sense of feeling like they're comfortable. But I hope that as far as the rest of the population goes, that we get back to a sense of feeling like we can go out and hug our friends and hug our family and go on vacations and, you know, just living a day-to-day life where you not are so included, you know, inside your home and not leaving and not going to enjoy those day-to-day joys of life. You know, I don't think that's one thing that people don't talk about is a lot of the depression and things that came from this, which is a huge, heavy topic. And we've seen a lot of suicides, a lot of attempts of suicides in our hospital. Gunshot wounds, things like that. I've taken taken care of patients with, and they will straight up tell you that they have not seen their family and they have been so lonely that they had no other option. So I think that is something that is no, that's not talked about on the news, and that's not talked about in public because no one wants to talk about mental health, right? Yeah. You know, that's a big thing that people don't want to talk about. And I get it. It's a hard topic. A lot of times people have family that have struggled from it and don't know how to address it in a public way, but it needs to be talked about because a lot of people are depressed because of this virus. And not to say it was not the correct way to go about being isolated and things like that, but a lot of people struggle and a lot of people are choosing to take their lives or do other measures because of that, you know, being so lonely. We are built to have human contact. We are built to have those emotions with other individuals. So when you take that most precious thing away from us, that's big, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm so glad you mentioned that. And I think about too, like the children who are missing school time and, I think of like the high schoolers who are missing their prom or their sports.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I was in high school, I hated school. I was a social person. So like, I couldn't have cared less about school, but like if I would be going through high school now, I would be really affected by it as like a teenager developing, and sports were my jam. So if I had to miss sports and then not be able to socialize and talk to people, I mean, I would have been really struggling. So I think about the teens and their brains aren't even fully developed yet. So I know that they're struggling, and you're so right. The mental health aspect of this has been crushing in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and my husband being a teacher, we've kind of seen that firsthand too with his Zoomers versus his in-class students that have chosen to come in still. And his Zoomers are all failing. I mean, they are. He's like, there's no contact to be like, hey, look, let's work on this together. You know, it's a lot more up to the parents. Parents are busy still working. So it's hard. It's super hard. And being away from their friends was a big outlet for kids that age, you know? It's just a lot of that stuff isn't talked about, you know, I think. And there's also things with, as far as like domestic violence and that kind of stuff that has gone on more because of this, because they're so isolated in a home. So, you know, there's a lot of parts of COVID that tons of negative has come from this, but there's a lot of parts that aren't talked about. That I think is super important to spread awareness about, you know, just in the sense being that it's not just all in the hospital that COVID has affected. It's in those nursing homes where people are lonely. It's in your general homes, a house across the street that, you know, you have a kid and a family and things are happening that we don't know about behind closed doors. And for a lot of these kids, their outlet was school to get out of the home. And we've taken that away. And that is a big, big deal. Things people don't talk about that much. I think that's important to mention.
What do you think everyone should know, you know, from your standpoint as a nurse? What's the number one thing you hope people take away from COVID or just know about COVID from kind of what you've seen from being on the front lines of it? What do you just kind of want everyone to know about what's happened?
You know, this last year has been draining. But I can thankfully say that there's hope. I think that is one thing to take away from everything that's gone on. Being firsthand, seeing it go from like this way all the way up, we see a huge peak of tons of patients coming in to now we're on the downfall because of probably exposure, people in, you know, cities and stuff like that, getting all the exposure and people running through the course of COVID. But hope, just knowing that there's hope for it, you know, these vaccines are out. Get them if you feel comfortable. If you don't, and you're in a population like us that aren't as at risk, you know, do the things necessary for you and your family, but know that there's hope for everything, you know? And I also think to really recognize too, that pushing exercise and eating well and those kind of things that really benefit your body and really kind of showed during this COVID time too, you know, with those people that didn't necessarily take care of their body so well and they were hit the worst. So I think that's been a big thing for me and even my husband, just making sure that we're being physically active and we're teaching our children to do so too, and just making your body as strong as it can be to do what it's naturally built to do, which is to fight off these viruses and bacterial infections and things like that. When your body's not its optimal, when you're not feeling at your optimal, your body's not going to fight it. It's optimal. So things like that, those little kind of key points, just giving your body proper nutrition. There is hope. I truly believe that we will get back to a more normal world here shortly. I'm hoping after the vaccines come out a little bit more, then we can get a little bit more normalcy. I think that's the biggest takeaway from COVID. We can get through it together, you know?
Yeah, I think we're close to being there, but I want to leave on a happy note, and I want to hear, what is the thing that you're most excited to do that you maybe haven't done in the past year? For me, it's traveling. I can't wait to travel again. What about you?
Me too. Travel. I'm actually going to like Destin, Florida in a week. And then I go on a bachelorette party like 2 weeks after that. And I have got a couple things lined up this year, a bunch of weddings pushed back, and a lot of them were destination weddings. So I think at the end of the year, I'm like in Florida, Mexico twice. So we have a lot going on in this year, which is like such a breath of fresh air, even to get away in, you know, I even have gone to Kansas City a couple of times to visit some girlfriends down there. And it's like a breath of fresh air. Just like get out of the environment, feel like you're like talking to people again, like in a normal setting. Most excited. I cannot wait to travel and just get out of Lincoln and get out of the environment and just feel like a little bit of normalcy.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. That sounds so fun. Oh my gosh. I'm so excited. You're doing all the traveling. I don't have anything planned, but I need to.
I know. Yes. Plan some trips.
Yeah. I love it. Brittany, thank you so much for being so open and honest about just your experience. And thank you for your service as a nurse. It's incredible what you've done. I'm sure, as you said, this past year has not been easy for you emotionally, physically, mentally, but thank you so much.
Well, of course. Yes. Couldn't have done it without the team that I work with. So yeah, it is great.
That was registered nurse Brittany Sheffert. A huge thank you to Brittany for volunteering her story and just being so transparent and open and honest about this topic that is really hard to A, have experienced, and B, to probably, you know, recall everything and what you were going through. So I just want to give her another huge shout out for coming on and sharing her story. Really incredible. Real quick before I leave, remember to follow along on Instagram. We are at Candidly Speaking Podcast. Stay up to date there. You can also find me in daily life and all my shenanigans at Carrie.Gillespie. Also, if you are a fan of the show and coming back often, first of all, thanks for doing that. And second of all, it would mean the world to me if you went to Apple Podcasts, left us a rating, and wrote a little review about why you like the show. It just really helps the show grow and be found by more and more people. And it just puts a smile on my face, you guys. It's like a virtual hug. Like, just spread the love. It would mean the world to me. So head on over and do that real quick. I promise you, it'll take 2.5 seconds and, guaranteed endorphin release, I promise. All right, y'all, that's going to do it for this week. Thanks so much for being here. I love y'all so much. I hope you have an amazing week, and I will see you again next time.